Hello and welcome to another podcast at manxradio.com. I'm Mark Tiley. Now, last week I spoke with John Rhys-Davies for MyTunes, and he chose some beautiful tracks that you're going to hear now. But we also talked about so many other things. I thought I really should put an extended edition together for the podcast. So that is precisely what I have done. Hope you enjoy it. Here he is. Oh, let's have him singing, first of all.
A British tar is a soaring soul, as free as a mountain bird. His energetic fist should be ready to resist
the dictator. John Rhys-Davies as Salah from Raiders of the Lost Ark. Loads more to come about Indiana Jones and Lord of the Rings, and so much more. Sit back and enjoy the full, extended MyTunes podcast with John Rhys-Davies.
Mark Tiley, the nation's station, Manx Radio.
Welcome to another MyTunes on Manx Radio. Now, my guest this week could thrill us with various voices and various parts. But for most of this week, he will be himself. Please welcome to MyTunes, John Rhys-Davies.
Thank you for having me on your show.
It's lovely to have you here. We, of course, will talk Lord of the Rings. We, of course, will talk Indiana Jones. And we will tease a little bit about the latter later. But more of that to come. I would like to take you right back to childhood to start with, John, because Tanganyika rings a bell growing up over there as a young lad?
Yes. It was a wonderful life. It was a very solitary life. And really, I did not have anyone to play with, so I really didn't learn to play. And that probably affected me a lot longer than it should have done. It's probably only in recent years that I've actually really started to really like people. Shameful thing to say when you're an old man, isn't it?
Well, it's understandable if you were, as you say, pretty much on your own over there.
Yes. I mean, I had my own rifle when I was about 8. Couldn't understand why I wasn't allowed to take a rifle to school, for God's sake. I mean, it seemed perfectly reasonable to me. Shot my first buffalo when I was 11. And all that's changed now, of course. I mean, I could tell you, I could draw that imaginary line between the ear and the eye of an elephant on the left-hand side where you get the brain shot in. I would no more think about shooting an elephant now than I would have, of shooting a child. I had an intimate relationship with a lovely elephant about 10, 12 years ago. And unfortunately, they put her down a few years afterwards. She was 60 years old and had a bit of arthritis in the back, but she was just wonderful. I like elephants. In fact, it's my totem, my African totem, Timbo.
Were you moving between boarding school and Africa, or did you relocate when you went to school?
Well, no, my father went out when I was 3. And we joined him when I was about 4 and a bit. And then I got sent off to a boarding school in England when I was about 8, to Truro down in Cornwall, which I hated. I really was an unreconstructed loner,
And without his rifle.
Without his rifle. Yeah. And sometimes you obviously could have used it there as well. But Truro was a very good school for me. It had a great tradition of acting, for instance. I mean, Robert Shaw had been there. When I played Othello in the school play, my Michael Cassio was Nigel Terry. The only way you can really survive in my profession or these professions, where you're spending so much time on your own, is to have an absolute self-discipline. No drugs, absolutely. And no solitary drinking. If you're alone in a room with a bottle of something, you will eventually acquire an addiction. And poor old Nigel became an absolute alcoholic and unemployable, and in the end he was seen wandering around Truro, dressed like a tramp, and died. And what a shame, because he had so much talent.
Great, great sadness. Yeah. Your route to Rada was via...
the University of East Anglia.
Yes, I would say Norfolk, yes.
Well, you see, Kate, the beloved Kate, whom I still speak to, would you believe, she got into Cambridge, and I got drunk at the interview and didn't get into Cambridge. So the nearest thing to Cambridge was the University of East Anglia, which was a brand new university.
Well, when you say nearest, in geographical terms, maybe not in academic terms. I just put that there.
Yeah, well, I actually I had the offer of an exhibition to Manchester, and even a place at Lincoln, Oxford, if I got O-level Latin. Davis, you've not got a snowflake's chance in hell of passing O-level Latin. So I ended up at the University of East Anglia, one of 105 original students.
Yeah, brand new.
Yeah,
brand new.
Physically actually helped to build the university. Founded the Dramatic Society, sort of cornered all the good parts in it anyway for the first couple of years. Founded every political party. I was rabidly left-wing in those days. Campaigned for a very nice chap who won Norwich South for Labour. Did the Aldermaston marches, banned the bomb. In other words, behaved in the absolutely irresponsible way that any self-respecting young idiot should. Had a wonderful time. Made the mistake of reading English. I really wanted to write, you see. And I read English. And English and a bit of philosophy. We had a splendid fellow there called Marcus Dick, who is, in fact, the father of the Metropolitan Police Commissioner.
Cressida.
Cressida.
Oh, right.
I've met three or four people in my life who've had an intelligence of an absolutely different order to most of us. I mean, you know, you can say of some of your friends, he's really smart. But there are just one or two people or three people you meet in your life who are of a different order. And Marcus was one of them. He'd had a wonderful war. He'd got a first in part ones or something like that. Gone off and been a tank captain in North Africa. Came back after the war. Got a starred first in the Tripos. Automatically elected as a fellow of Balliol, you know, and did an advanced degree at Harvard or someplace like that, Princeton, you know, in mathematical philosophy. Came back and was expected to do great things and didn't. And indeed, of course, ends up becoming an alcoholic, essentially. And it was very sad because, you know, oh, God, I've got to go back up to Oxford. I've left my manuscript up there this weekend and, you know, the book that was going to change mathematical philosophy. I never really understood what motivated him and what he was about, really, until I read a book called The Fly and the Fly Bottle by Ved Mehta, which is Encounters with English Intellectuals. And it mentions a man called J.L. Austin, who was a linguistic philosopher, who wrote a very deceptively sounding book called How to Do Things with Words. And the passage from Mehta went like this. While Austin was alive, many of the younger Oxford philosophers could not write anything. For when they wrote a paragraph and read it back, they heard J.L. Austin's dry voice, take it apart, utterance by utterance, and demonstrate that it had no meaning. Really sort of a completely creatively emasculating. And working with Dick on that, doing philosophy with him, I realized that I could see the problems in almost every sentence that we utter. And I didn't have the intelligence to be able to see through it. Mm. And I didn't have the common sense to dismiss it as tough. So whenever I got an essay title, you know, about Ibsen's tragedy then, you know, I would start to try and define tragedy, you know, and you go to your Aristotle, which I'd learned many years before. Tragedy, then, is the imitation of an action complete and of some importance, acted, not narrated, in language enhanced by distinct and varying means, and through pity and fear, effecting its purgation of these emotions. And you... Sorry about that. In the end, mentally, I wasn't mature enough to deal with the university. And I really wasted my time there. I mean, I read everybody who wasn't on the course. I was afraid to fail. Mm. You know, I did not want to be regarded as less than best, and therefore I could not risk judgment.
Tomorrow we will talk about RADA, and we'll talk about all sorts of other things. But let's have our first piece of music.
Ah, yes. Well, after I left university, I did one bit of television, which turned into several parts in a series called Budgie. And this is a piece of music by a man whom I came to really like and befriend, Adam Faith. Lovely man. Came to stay with me the last time he went bankrupt in L.A., and we had a wonderful time together. There was that mixture of street smart, gentleness, and just curiosity. He'd had no real education, but he was one of those people that the 44 Education Act had bypassed, really. Lovely man, and I miss him so much. I miss him so much. Adam, come on then, Adam. Let's hear you saying, what do you want, or something like that.
What do you want if you don't want money? What do you want if you don't want gold? Say what you want and I'll give it you, darling. Wish you wanted my love, baby. What do you want if you don't want earning? What do you want if you don't want those? Say what you want and I'll give it you, darling. Wish you wanted my love, baby. Well, I'm offering you this heart of mine, but all you do is play it cool. What do you want, oh boy, you're making a fool of me. One of these days when you need my kissing, one of these days when you want me to, don't turn around cause I'll be missing. Then you want my love, baby. Well, I'm offering you a diamond ring, but all you do is turn me down. What do you want, oh boy, you're going to down on me. One of these days when you need my kissing, one of these days when you want me to, don't turn around cause I'll be missing. Then you want to my love, baby. Oh well, then you want to my love, baby.
My Tunes on Manx Radio, and I am delighted, thrilled and absolutely honoured, sir, to have John Rhys-Davies with me in the studio. Because not only is he a wonderful man, said yes, but you do live a lot of the time on the Isle of Man and have done for some years. Can you just tell us how that happened and when?
I'd just done Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. I had just moved out of the English tax system. And then I got asked to do something for Disney, Great Expectations. And I said, but look, I've only just got into the American tax system. I really don't want to be in the English one. And my producer said, no problem. I've got friends around Europe. We'll schedule you so that you can hop in and still stay under the 180 days. So, I mean, I did Malta and I did Spain and finally he said, well, look, I've got a mate of mine who's got a hotel on the Isle of Man. Why don't you go and stay there? I came, and I wanted to... My father had died about 18 months ago, before, and I wanted to write something that could express my love and regard for him. So I locked myself into the Palace Hotel, which was being renovated at the time, and wrote for a week. I'd hired a car, just parked at the Palace Hotel, wrote for a week. So on Saturday, I look at the 60 or 70 pages that I've written, and it's rubbish. In despair, I took the car, and I thought, well, I've done the south end of the island, and yeah, it's okay. I'll try the north end of the island. And I was driving up the coast road, and I came to a place called Ballatea. I saw a sail agreed sign, and I looked, and I saw a white house set in green fields on the edge of a cliff overlooking the sea. And I thought, oh, God, I've always wanted to have a place like that. Oh, well, what the heck? I'll just go up there. If there's somebody there, I'll say, look, I apologize. I just wanted to be nosy. So I had a look around, and then I went up, found my way down to the beach. And it really puzzled me, because parts of the house were clearly 15th century or earlier, and nobody built that close to the sea in the 15th century. And I suddenly realized what my story was about. It's a man who abandons his life and his love and his partner and his friends and buys an old house on a cliff overlooking the sea. And the sea is attacking the cliff, and the house is doomed. And he determines he will stop the sea. And it was one of those wonderful moments where, when you write, you stand there, and in the course of 2 minutes, you see every scene just going like that. And then I said, well, I've always wanted to make a film, and this is the film I'm going to make, and I'm going to make it here. So the next day I called up the estate agent, and I said, this Ballatea, oh, I'm afraid it is under offer, yes. And I said, yes, but, I mean, has the guy had his, has it surveyed? Has he got his mortgage in place and all that sort of thing? No. Well, how long has this been going on? When are you going to exchange? Well, it's been 9 weeks now. And I said, 9 weeks now? Do you realize what you have cost, you know, the seller? Because it was that time, 89, 88, 89, 90, when suddenly interest rates went high.
Oh, yeah, through the roof.
And the pound dropped and things like that. I said, you probably cost her $10,000, $20,000. I said, you will make an offer. And so I added 15 grand to what was being offered and said, please, you will make the... Well, we don't like gazumping. I said, this isn't gazumping. This is clearly not going to happen. Call her. I got a call from her. Are you for real? Yes, ma'am. I will exchange in a week, and I'll complete the following week and I bought it.
That was the beginning.
That was the beginning
here.
And then, of course, it gets all mucky after that, doesn't it? I wrote the story, and in fact, I have some interest in the story being revived again. But anyway, that was a lot of personal pain involved in it, and I ended up tearing up the script and throwing it away. But it's a good yarn.
And, of course, and it may surface again.
I'm hoping so.
Good.
That's one thing we should talk about, because I am going to make some films now. I've been building this little studio here for some time, and it is now time that I went out and shook the money tree, and we've got to talk about it sometime.
Good. We will.
Right.
Let us have a piece of music, sir. What's it going to be?
Well, I thought I'd just play the music of some of the wonderful musicians that I've known and met. And this one, of course, I met at the Welsh Assembly, the inauguration of the Welsh Assembly. And we got fairly drunk together and toasted the Prince of Wales and his mum. He is one of the greatest rock and rollers. He is still doing it. And girls still throw their knickers on the stage for dear old Tom Jones.
Well, just before we play it, I just want to explore your Welshness. Where through the line ancestry does it sort of come?
As far as I know, it is 100% ancestry, certainly to the 16th century.
Ah.
You see, the sad thing about the Welsh was that all the chapel records were gathered and sent to Cardiff University. In the First World War, the Zeppelins were bombing Cardiff, and they took all those records and put them in a coal mine, and the mine flooded. And so all those early records the genealogists count on were lost. I had the privilege of working, oh, I should have mentioned the Mormon Tabernacle Choir as well. Good Lord, I did a Christmas show with them. And they've got some great genealogists there. And they very kindly sort of tell me that I'm related to Madison, who was, I think, the third president, but very remotely, obviously. And one of the things I did find about that Welsh ancestry, there was one guy there who, when we first see him in the census, is down as weaver or wool spinner or something like that. It's just cottage industry stuff. And he makes his mark. And every time he makes his cross, when he's 21 and he marries, he makes his cross in the book. He can't write. And we slowly see through the census years, he becomes suddenly mill owner. He's bought a little place and now he's employing four or five people. And then 10 years later, mill owner and victualler. He's branching out again. At his last, he had three wives. They all died of cancer in their mid-40s. And at his last wedding, he signs in a beautiful copper plate his name. And he leaves his son £1,700, which was a huge amount of money.
And what year would that be, John?
Oh, this would be in the early 1800s, mid-1800s.
That's a lot of money, as you say. Huge, yes.
Now, let me tell you that I am the first of my family to go to university. Some people would say I'm a moderately successful achiever. I think that that life is a far more successful life than mine. You know, to start from where he starts, that abject poverty, you know, and to work your way up to being able to read and write at an old age and make it in life and find that respectability and be able to write. That's achievement.
The old hometown looks the same as I step down from the train, and there to meet me is my mama and papa. Down the road I look, and there runs Mary, hair of gold and lips like cherries. It's good to touch the green, green grass of home. Yes, they'll all smiling sweetly. It's good to touch the green, green grass of home. The old house is still standing, though the paint is cracked and dry, and there's that old oak tree cherries. It's good to touch the green, green grass of home. Then I awake and look around me at four gray walls that surround me, and I realize, yes, I was only dreaming. For there's a God, and there's a sad old portrait. On and on we'll walk at daybreak. again I'll touch the green, green grass of home. Yes, they'll all come to see me in the shade of that old oak tree as they lay me 'neath the green, green grass of home.
My tunes this week on Mark Tiley in the Morning with our friends at Short Isle of Man. And my guest all week is the wonderful John Rhys-Davies. In case, dear listener, you're thinking I'm not hearing enough of him, these are too short. You'll be delighted to know the full-length podcast, when there's so much more to discover about our guest, will be available after Thursday's transmission. Because, John, we don't give it all away at once. It's not right.
Hey, well, I don't give it away at all myself, you know. I'm very, very frugal in these matters.
I did say at the beginning of the week we'd investigate many facets. Going through your credits, television, film, etc., etc., it's unbelievable how many parts you've had, and they're different, and they're amazingly diverse. When you were at RADA and you were sort of honing your skills, was there something you thought, I want to be like him, or I want to do that? Was there something in your head driving you through RADA?
You understand that I was, and probably still am, an idiot.
No. Right.
Why did I go to RADA? I'll tell you why I went to RADA. Because I didn't know of any other drama school. I thought, well, of course I've got genius. They're bound to take me. When I auditioned for RADA, they auditioned 2,500 people for 21 places. It was harder to get into RADA than it was into Balliol. And I got in, and I did have a good time. I did enjoy it, and I did learn some things. Of course, I didn't do it properly. And I dropped out of RADA in my last term. It was a seven-term course. I dropped out of the sixth course because I had an opportunity to go and work in repertory. So I did a show on Sunday night, and Monday morning, first thing, I presented myself at the Belgrade Theatre, Coventry, to play the inspector in Murder at the Vicarage. Warren Jenkins was the director. He was a lovely old boy. He was a Quaker, and he'd been a stretcher bearer in China during the Second World War. John, I knew I was dying of the cholera because I vomited up my worm. It was about 6 or 7 feet long.
Good grief.
And the other boys had all died, but I got over it somehow. And anyway, now let's talk about you, John. Now, go on. And now, John, there are two sorts of parts. There are good parts, and there are challenges. And I've got another challenge for you this week.
And he was your director.
He was my director.
Sounds like he was a bit of a mentor as well.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Yes, he was. He was at the end of his life and really running on, you know, the smell of an oily rag, as they would say in motoring circuits. Didn't direct us too much, you know. I'd love to, but I've got to go. Special thing with Charles, Prince of Wales, got to go there now. And you, but you boys run it and this sort of thing, you know.
Lovely.
And of course, it did teach us to run it. There's nothing like the fear of going to a first night when nobody knows what the heck they're doing. I had 7 weeks out of work in my first 5 years. I just went from job to job to job.
Which, if anybody's not convinced, is remarkable. At that time, at that part of your career, that is remarkable.
But you see, there were the opportunities then. We had repertory and things like that. I shared a house with Lee Lawson, who ended up marrying Twiggy, David Suchet's wife. We all worked, you know, and we went from job to job. And you made your mistakes. And as you know, it's not your successes that teach you anything. It's your failures You know, that, you know, when you think, I've got this new edgy way of playing this part. It's never been done like this before. And you go out there on the first night and you can just tell the audience hates it. Mm. They hate it. They think you're awful. And you're going to be doing this for the next 3 weeks and you have to start recrafting the part again. Wonderful.
Let's spool forward to the phone call that said, we're doing this film called Indiana Jones. We've got a part for you. It's quite a strange part. You might like it. How did that call go to become integral into that Indiana Jones?
Well, I had done Shogun. I had done Shogun because a lovely old casting lady called Maud Spector had come home from the theatre one night and switched on the television. She had a problem. She had a bit difficult piece of casting to do for the Americans. And she switched on and she saw me. She saw me for 10 minutes on a London weekend television program, which was the reconstruction of a crime. And I got the job basically because my bank manager phoned up and said, you're £110 overdrawn. What are you going to do about it? I call my manager, marvellous manager. I'd still be with them if they were alive. And said, look, bank manager on me. I need something. I need a couple hundred quid if you can. Leave it with me, John. Comes back next day and said, London weekend, doing this, da-da-da-da-da, got to be perfect. So I did it. Maud Spector comes in, sees it, and casts me as Rodriguez in Shogun, which, next to Roots, was at the time
massive,
the most successful miniseries of all time at that time.
Yeah.
I even got an Emmy nomination out of it. From that, I got cast in Victor Victoria with Blake Edwards.
Julie Andrews.
And Julie. Oh,
lovely.
Darling Julie Andrews. And from that, Blake came up to me one day and he said, Steven Spielberg gave me a call and wants to know what you're like. And I said he's semi-competent, but he might do just right for his part. So I got sent the script. And my manager called me up and said, well, what do you think? And I said, I've never read a script like this. It's all description. Very little dialogue, all description. And he said, well, you don't have to do it, you know. And Spielberg had just done 1941, which we actually regard as a rather good film.
Well, I was going to say, I liked it. It got panned.
Yes,
absolutely panned. Yeah.
And suddenly all the wolves were out saying, well, of course, Flash in the Pan, wasn't it? You know, one of these up-and-coming kids who just, you know, and this sort of thing. And I said, no, I think I'd love to do it, actually. Look, what can I say, Howard? This is either going to be the biggest disaster of all time, or it might just set a new fashion in filmmaking.
We'll be right back.
the classic theme from Indiana Jones. Not one of John's choices, by the way, just had to put that in. But here comes one of his choices, and he's going to tell us a little bit about how he got to know the late John Denver.
John and I did a pilot for a television series which was going to be picked up. I loved the man. He had wit, intelligence, charm, some measure of pain inside him. Life had not gone that easily. But he was just lovely and so funny. Some of the songs that he sang to us were so scurrilous and scandalous and politically incorrect. But he was a very experienced pilot, and it was going to involve some of his piloting. And since I was flying at the time as well, you know, we had that in common. I mean, he had a lot of experience. He had 2,600 hours in jets. You know, this is pretty rare for a civilian. And he had every sort of plane. He'd bought a Rutan Canard plane. I think it was a Long Easy, or maybe in a Very Easy. Now, the Canard planes are really unstallable. When they stall, the nose drops and they dive down 300 feet and level off. It was a second-hand plane, but he'd always wanted a Rutan, and he'd got jets as well and things like that. And he took off out of Santa Monica, and he developed either fuel shortage or a fuel tank trouble. It's something that you would practice and you would know how to do instinctively, but it was literally, I think, his first or second time he'd been in the plane. And he'd only got about 400, 500 feet over the water, and he started losing power, and he just did not have enough time. Didn't have enough time, bought the farm.
Yeah.
When I heard he died, I cried. He had magic about him. He had an energy and an innocence and a warmth. And he was just one of those really special people. And, I mean, we all know country, home and all that sort of thing, but I want to play a different one. I'd like to play that wonderful and exhilarating "I'm Just a Country Boy," because that's the John I knew, just so up.
Well, life on the farm is kind of laid back. Ain't much an old country boy like me can't hack. It's early to rise, early in the sack. I thank God I'm a country boy. Well, a simple kind of life never did me no harm. Raising me a family and working on the farm. Days are all filled with an easy country charm. Thank God I'm a country boy. Well, I got me a fine wife, I got me old fiddle. When the sun's coming up, I got cakes on the griddle. Life ain't nothing but a funny, funny riddle. Thank God I'm a country boy. When the work's all done and the sunset low, pull out my fiddle and the rosin up the bow. Kids are asleep, so I keep a catalog. And thank God I'm a country boy. I'd play Sally Gooden all day if I could, but the Lord and my wife wouldn't take it very good. So I fiddle when I can, work when I should, and thank God I'm a country boy. Well, I got me a fine wife, I got me old fiddle. When the sun's coming up, I got cakes on the riddle. Life ain't nothing but a funny, funny riddle. Thank God I'm a country boy. Diamonds or jewels, I never was one of them money-hungry fools. Rather have my fiddle and my farming tools. Thank God I'm a country boy. Yeah, city folk driving in a black limousine. A lot of sad people thinking that's a mighty keen. Son, let me tell you now exactly what I mean. I thank God I'm a country boy. Well, I got me a fine wife, I got me old fiddle. When the sun's coming up, I got cakes on a griddle. Life ain't nothing but a funny, funny riddle. Thank God I'm a country boy. Yeah. fiddle, but my daddy's till the day he died. And he took me by the hand, held me close to his side, said, live a good life, play my fiddle and cry. And thank God, oh, I'm such a boy. Well, my daddy taught me young how to hunt and how to whittle, taught me how to work and play a tune on the fiddle, taught me how to love and how to give just a little. And thank God, I'm a country boy. Well, I got me a fine wife, I got me old fiddle. When the sun's coming up, I got cakes on the griddle. Life ain't nothing but a funny, funny riddle. Woo! Thank God, I'm a country boy, yeah!
When I was at school, there were some people who would read Lord of the Rings again and again and again and again. And it became their, I'm going to say, entire life. And some of us just read it and thought, oh, that was quite nice. I want to know where John Rhys-Davies sat when you were growing up, long before you ever knew you were going to be in it. What were you a huge fan of the book?
Awful, interminable book. Number one son, Ben, came home from the Dragon School at Oxford at half term, disappeared into his room and only came down for meals and read Lord of the Rings and loved it. Number two son, Tom, who went to Shrewsbury, he and I tried to read it together and we kept falling asleep. Not my sort of thing at all. So when we... when I got offered the chance of doing it, I thought, oh, God. You know, this is a little chap in New Zealand who's made one or two small good films. Anybody can make a four-hander or a six-hander in 4 weeks or 6 weeks and do it. It's not rocket science, that sort of stuff. But he has no idea what he's letting himself into. The point being that, you know, Lord of the Rings has 22 principal characters. It was meant to be shot over 14 months with little gaps in between. It was unfilmable. It is not possible to make a film of Lord of the Rings. It wasn't designed at that. That was one of the reasons why Tolkien let it go very cheaply when he had an income tax bill. Anyway, I'll do one of those sort of minor nobles at the end because I've never been to New Zealand. You know, a month in New Zealand, get to see the place, you know, take the money and run, and it'll be fine. And they came back and offered me Gimli the Dwarf. And I said, I don't want to do this.
They did realise how tall you were at the time, did they?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, I know it's all magic and trickery, but they must have thought, how can we make him look very small? I suppose they just do it.
I spent a lot of time on my knees. And that was after getting the job. My manager at the time, Louis, said, oh, don't worry, John, they'll get it down to about an hour of makeup. And I said, you don't know what's involved in this. This is going to be hours and hours of sitting in the chair. And more than that, you know, it's not going to go beyond, you know, the first one will come out, the second one will go direct to video and things like that. You can't make a film of this. It's a waste of time. Number one son, Ben, who had read it, I said to him, you know, that my manager has just said to me, John, if you don't do this film, we can no longer continue to represent you.
You see, he was probably, along with just over 50% of the world's population, who were just waiting for this movie. The other lot were sort of lukewarm, but so it's billions of people were waiting for this.
Dad, forgive me, but if you turn this down, I think you're nuts.
Yeah.
Why is that, my son? Because, Dad, when you go into a bookshop anywhere in the world, there is at least a 2-foot section of books by Tolkien. Just imagine the readership there. Anyway, I went and did it, and one of the hardest jobs I've ever had. The makeup took forever. I mean, I'd spend between 5 and 8 hours a day in the chair. And... you know, the prosthetic was complete. I mean, all you could see was my eyes and a little bit of my lips. and the rest of the press. One of the reasons why Gimli looks so narrow-eyed is we were putting so much padding there, and that distance between the eye centre and there, you can't really fake.
So they made your head a lot bigger. Yes, so your eyes look... Ah, that's clever. And go back to the height. Did they have to get very tall people to walk with you on some time? Things like that?
Or we did that. We had a lovely guy who ended up in the New Zealand Police Force, I believe. He was a basketball player, and I think 6'9", 6'10".
Ah.
And he would walk on a platform about 18 inches, 2 feet high. And I would walk beside him. So you wouldn't actually see the upper part of his body. But we made a belt that was about 6 or 7 inches wide. And a scabbard, which was about 6 or 7 inches wide as well. Now we know that a belt and a sword scabbard aren't that size. They're small. So if I'm walking next to him, since we know the size of those things,
yeah,
I must be relatively smaller.
Well, all being equal, you won't have to play him again, and you won't have to go through all the makeup. And I remember hearing you tell us about the damage to your eyes and the glue and awful stuff. Mm. However, I don't know how much we can say about this. There's twittering going on about you going back into... Dun, 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 dun. I'm very, very excited. What can you say, and when do you have to shoot me?
I can neither confirm nor deny. just theoretically, just remotely, were I called to serve, I would be contractually not allowed to comment about it. And one must assume, therefore, that I have no knowledge of the subject to which you are alluding.
Excellent. If you'd like to Google Indiana Jones plans for the summer, you might find out more than our dear guest, who is the wonderful John Rhys-Davies, is allowed, or what I'd never expect him to say. I can't wait. can't wait. Because they were a mixed bag of movies, in all honesty, John. The ones with you in, I think, I'm not saying because you're here, were the best. And there's been a few moments.
Every time I bump into Spielberg, I always say, Indiana Jones, 1 and 3, marvellous. 2 and 4, really missing something, aren't they? What is it? What element is it?
I think we know what's missing. Too joyous. It's been a wonderful week. As I say, if you haven't heard enough, and you haven't, trust me, you have not heard enough of our conversation. The whole thing will be as a podcast shortly, actually, in about 45 minutes. If I can nail it together quickly, I'll get it out. It'll be on this afternoon. I want to just go back for our final piece of music. Annie Lennox. Now, there's a national treasure.
Not only a national treasure, she is just one of these bright, intelligent, deep, thinking, passionate people. I cannot claim to know her well. I had the privilege of bumping into her a couple of times when she was singing this next song for the film that I happened to be in. And all I can say is that just meeting her was a privilege. She is a jewel. Obviously, the song that you and I would most like of her is, of course, Why, which is one of those great romantic songs. But the one that I've chosen, actually, is the one that I saw her sing and help create in the studio for Lord of the Rings, and it is Into the West.
John, thank you for a wonderful, wonderful week. We'll play this right now. And I hope you get a song again. I'd like to hear you sing in the next movie, if there is one, by the way, with the man with the whip and the hat. But I'd like a little song from you next time. We always enjoy those moments.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Thank you so much.
Lay down your sweet and weary head. Night is falling. You've come to journey's end. Sleep now, dream. the ones who came before. They are calling from across the distant shore. Why do you weep? What are these tears upon your face? Soon you will see all of your fears will pass away, safe in my arms. You're only sleeping. What can you see?
What a beautiful piece of music from Annie Lennox from the film trilogy Lord of the Rings. My thanks again to John Rhys-Davies for joining us for My Tunes, and I do hope you enjoyed the extended version here at manxradio.com. I'm Mark Tiley. More My Tunes podcasts and loads more podcasts coming every day to manxradio.com, and I hope you can join me for the morning show, the Shore Morning Show, 9:30 to 12, Monday to Friday on Manx Radio.